Sahib Shihab leading off on baritone sax on Chronic Blues with John Coltrane on tenor, following close behind. This is Coltrane's debut as a soul band leader, and it was recorded and released in 1957. At the time, he was fulfilling a recording contract with Bob Weinstock, owner of Prestige Records, that obligated Coltrane to do 3 albums a year for the grand sum of $300 per album. Also on this particular tune, we have Johnny Splon on trumpet. Hamid Blewett is among my favorites, but Sahib Shihab takes his place here. Mal Waldron on piano. Paul Chambers on bass, and Albert Tootie Heath on drums. This is Lead Stories. I'm Utrice Lead. It is Monday, April the 14th, and 2 issues we'll be tackling today. President Obama's tote that barge, lift that bale, his typical message when he's talking to blacks. We'll get to that. But first, we go to Detroit, where today the city of Detroit is expected to submit to federal judge Stephen Rhodes its third version of a bankruptcy exit plan, forecasting that the city will emerge from bankruptcy by October the 15th. City unions and hundreds of other petitioners, however, are dead set against the draconian cuts that emergency manager Kevin Orr is proposing in his bid to settle the nation's largest municipal bankruptcy in record time. Abayomi Ezekwe, who has been corresponding with us and for us on this particular issue, is at it again. Thank you so much, Abayomi. Abayomi Ezekwe is editor of Pan-African Newswire, and he is a Detroit organizer for the Workers' World Party. Thanks, Abayomi.
Thank you for having me on once again.
Well, here we go. Today, the third plan is delivered. Tell us about that.
Yeah, there's been several revisions in the so-called, quote, plan of adjustment, unquote. We call it the banker's plan of adjustment because it provides preference for the financial institutions over and above the workers, the retirees, and the city residents in regard to resolving the bankruptcy issue. And I have to keep reiterating the fact that, first of all, the city of Detroit did not file bankruptcy, did not file for a state of emergency. This was all done over and above the heads and in contravention to the political wishes of the people of the city over a year ago by a multi-million-dollar right-wing racist Republican governor, Rick Snyder, in Lansing, who's up for re-election in November. So when you read in the corporate media that Detroit is doing this and Detroit is doing that, these people are dictators over the affairs of the city of Detroit. Jones Day Law Firm, which is a multi-billion dollar law firm that Kevin Orr was a former partner of, who has now been appointed over the last year as emergency manager. So there's clearly a conflict of interest. Here you have an emergency manager who is the former partner of a firm that is put in charge of not only legally representing the city, but also hiring consultants to supposedly restructure the city's finances and its operations. So it's all a sham, And it's all designed to get to the, first of all, $5 to $6 billion in pension funds that are in two different pension systems, to seize and also liquidate public city assets like the Detroit Institute of Arts, Belle Isle, the Detroit Water and Sewage Department, the Detroit Public Lighting Department, and other city assets. And then at the same time, ensnarl further the working people of the city into perpetual debt on disadvantageous terms. And that is the real agenda that they're putting forward. And if they're able to get away with it here in Detroit, they have plans for the rest of the United States, from New York State all the way to California. But the situation involving this plan of adjustment, the disclosure portion of it, has no concrete, specific information about not only the city's finances, but also what it intends to do to extricate the city out of bankruptcy. And this is what is critical. And a lot of the objections by ordinary ranking-file citizens of Detroit have requested this information from Jones Day Corporation and their agent, Kevin Orr, who's working on behalf of the banks, along with Governor Rick Snyder. So that's where we stand right now in this whole process. There's tremendous amount of opposition to what's going on here in the city. There are numerous lawsuits that are even dealing with the constitutionality of what's going on that are attempting to move forward in the Sixth Circuit Federal Courts of Appeals, but there's obstacles being put in the way of that litigation. So that's where we stand right now. But it's clear the banks are being favored in this whole process, and the workers, the retirees, and the residents are being attacked in this whole operation.
Well, I want, in that sense, since you just said that, on Friday, Judge Rhodes approved a settlement with the banks. Could you talk about that?
Yeah, it was very outrageous, and it even appeared to go against 180 degrees in the opposite direction of his ruling on January 16th, where he denied the second proposed agreement to terminate an interest rate swap with Bank of America and United Bank of Switzerland, UBS. The fact of the matter is we've already paid $300 million to these financial institutions over the last 8 years for nothing. We've gotten nothing out of it except more misery, more indebtedness, and more disempowerment for the people of the city, even the elected officials of the city. That's what people have to keep in mind, first of all. Then there were two other attempts in December and in January to reach agreements on the termination of these swap agreements outside of the regular bankruptcy proceeding. So that raises another question. Why should these people be given special preference? The huge multinational or transnational financial institutions, why should they be given preference over the other creditors? The smaller banks, bondholders, bond insurers, let alone the workers, the retirees, and the residents who also have an interest in this procedure. So the fact that it wasn't dismissed immediately is a clear indication that they want an out to provide some compensation to these banks. So the first deal was to the tune of some $280 million. That was rejected. And the judge ordered in December the parties, being Jones Day Law Firm, who was misrepresenting the people of the city of Detroit on behalf of the banks, and a negotiator, Kenneth Buckfire for Miller Buckfire Corporation, was involved in the negotiation, and Judge Gerald Rosen, who is a federal judge who has been appointed as mediator, along with these two financial institutions. They were involved in this negotiation process. They came up with another deal, which was also rejected by the judge on January the 16th. That was to the tune of some $165 million. So the judge even said in his ruling on January 16th that it was too much money, it was unreasonable, that the city was negotiating these deals with literally a gun pointed to their head. And he also said at quite length, that the city would have a basis to take legal action against Bank of America and UBS, not only to terminate the swaps, but also to regain hundreds of millions of dollars that we have paid to these financial institutions for absolutely no reason other than their own enrichment. And also, Jerome Goldberg, who has been the only real principal objector to this process, pointed out that these people in numerous financial institutions, including UBS as well as Bank of America, have been cited by the U.S. Justice Department. Even criminal charges have been brought against these people. Some have been fined. Some have even been imprisoned for fraud involving municipal finance as well as mortgage finance. But they do not want this factor put into any legal ruling involving this bankruptcy process, because what it raises the issue of the culpability of these financial institutions, not only in the destruction of Detroit, but in the destruction of the housing industry inside the United States, as well as the municipal finance industry, which is also being destroyed systematically across the United States. We're talking about a $3.7 trillion bond market industry in municipal finance right now that's facing some real critical challenges, and it also has a tremendous impact on pensions of retirees and also public assets. So it appears as if he did a reversal in this ruling, and obviously he's under pressure by his colleagues, by the powers that be in this country. There's a lot at stake in this bankruptcy. If they fail to reach their objectives, then this means that the whole process itself will be even further exposed for its flaws. This whole process has been rigged with what I perceive to be illegality and clearly unethical and undemocratic practice. He even went as far in his ruling on April the 11th, just this last past Friday, to say, to even take a swipe at those who have been in the streets, in the courts, in the media, opposing what Jones Day and Kevin Orr and the banks and Governor Snyder are trying to do to the people of Detroit and have done to the people of Detroit, by saying that now is not the time for public relations. Now is the time for negotiation. Well, negotiations based on what and on whose terms? And to make a statement like that, I think he really overstepped his bounds as a federal jurist, because first of all, it does not acknowledge the fact that there have already been negotiations over the last 3 to 4 years between previous Detroit administrations and unions and politicians. There have been massive cuts already in the municipal operations of the city. There's been tremendous privatization already. There was additional cost-cutting measures that were negotiated and agreed upon by the unions in the city prior to the appointment of the emergency manager and the declaration of a so-called financial emergency in Detroit in March of 2013. So to make a statement like that and not include the fact that workers have already taken cuts, already been willing to grant concessions, and to say now is the time to negotiate. So what he's actually saying is that the workers should take more concessions, that the retirees should be silent and allow for their pensions to be cut even deeper.
Wasn't it the same judge who said, yeah, and this is what was puzzling to me, when essentially he ruled on Friday basically that the terms are now amenable to him. Didn't he say that the arrangement made with the former mayor Kilpatrick, didn't he say previously that he thought it to be likely illegal?
Yes, there are questions that have been raised about the legality in terms of the state gaming laws by using casino tax revenue as collateral for such an interest rate swap deal. You know, all of these issues, they do not want litigated seriously in a courtroom because there's a lot at stake, because these swaps are in existence all across the U.S.
It does sound very odd that the same judge who says that he believes it to be likely illegal, that is the arrangement, the swaps deal that was put into effect by Kilpatrick, and yet basically agreeing on Friday to the terms that the banks want. This is very odd.
Yes. And people can reach whatever conclusions they come up with. But, yes, he agreed to this $85 million plan to terminate the swaps, which is $200 million less than what they had initially proposed. But at the same time, if you add the $300 million that have already been paid, plus the $85 million, which the judge okayed on Friday, as part of a deal to terminate a $550 million interest rate swap deal, that means that these people are being paid close to 70% of what they claim is owed to them on a deal, which in all probability was illegal from the beginning, and which has done nothing to benefit the residents of the city of Detroit. So it's just another effort to extort even more resources from the city, and also to give it a legal cover as well.
Now, what do we know so far about this October the 15th predicted date by Kevin Orr, a vicious Kevin Orr, who thinks that if the judge goes along with this plan, that Detroit could be back on the road to solvency by October the 15th, despite the fact that it is the largest municipal bankruptcy in U.S. history?
Yeah, I believe
What gives him the optimism that October the 15th, this could be a done deal?
Well, they want it to be a done deal because we have elections coming up in November, and Governor Snyder, who has done nothing for the state of Michigan except rob working people. He instituted right to work. He abolished personal property taxes for the businesses, the large businesses. The roads are in horrendous condition, probably the worst in the United States. A report recently by the Michigan Municipal League reported that some $6.2 billion has been systematically withheld from the cities over the last two administrations, not just the current Republican administration of Rick Snyder, but also the Democratic administration of Jennifer Granholm. So the cities in Michigan, and this is true all over the country, have been systematically starved of resources. And most of the priorities are being given to the financial institutions and the investors, who are given huge tax breaks. The people's taxes, property taxes, are being captured and channeled off into these downtown development authorities and economic growth development corporations, which is just another means of taking public funds and channeling into the bank accounts of private interests. And this is their scheme, because they come from private industry, people like Rick Snyder and Kevin Orr. So they are serving a corporate agenda, utilizing public resources. So this is the problem that is going on right now. But there's no guarantee whatsoever. And we can almost predict that Detroit will be in a much worse financial bind once these people leave. And they may not leave in October, because if they can't wrap this thing up to their satisfaction, they could always extend Orr's appointment. And they could also, extend the bankruptcy process as well. Even if they say the city is officially out of bankruptcy, if the judge declares that, the governor can still extend Orr's dictatorship for another period of time while they go and continue to, carry out their program. So it's no guarantee that October 15th we're going to wake up and everything will be just fine in the city of Detroit financially.
Finally, Wednesday is the next big court date. What is supposed to happen then?
Well, July the 16th, there's going to be a hearing on whether or not this plan of adjustment should be accepted. And there's a lot of pressure right now on the retirees and on the unions and on everyone who is opposing this process. The day prior to Judge Rhodes' ruling on Friday, which was on April the 10th, even prior to that, there was indication that an agreement had been reached with the so-called unsecured creditors. What they're talking about is the bondholders, some of the bondholders, some of the bond insurers, who also claim that they're owed money by the city of Detroit and its institutions. So they're using things like that to say, okay, now the capitalists have agreed to a some cut, you know, and what they claim is owed to them. And now these two banks have agreed to a $200 million haircut. So therefore, the retirees and the workers and the residents should agree to whatever Kevin Orr says they should take. So this is the type of pressure that's being exerted on people in the city. And the judge even pointed out in his ruling that that's what he wanted. And he even used the term cram down. Which
down,
is,
yes.
Yes, meaning that, you know, they're just going to want to just force or ram this down people's throats. The cancellation of their health care, which happened on March the 1st, anyone who was not eligible for Medicare, where you have to be 65 years old, I believe, to be eligible, they have to go into this Affordable Care Act program. And the stories we're getting is that some people have to pay anywhere between $500 and $1,000 a month and healthcare premiums with high deductibles and other fees for healthcare as a result of Kevin Orr's dictatorial abolition of their healthcare. So this is pressure that's being placed on the retirees, and now they're talking about up to a one-third if they don't vote in favor of this plan of adjustment, they may get up to one-third cuts in their monthly payments, and a portion of their annuities will be stolen. So these are the type of threats that are being leveled against the people. Then they say if they do agree to this plan of adjustment, then the cuts will be less. So this is the game that's being played, but I think the opposition to this plan is widespread, and it's going to be very difficult for them to sell this program to the people of the city of Detroit. And then the political considerations for Snyder and the others are also formidable as well. So this spring and this summer is really going to be very interesting in regard to developments here in Detroit.
Well, Abayomi, thank you so much for bringing us up to snuff on this continuing debacle. It is going through a number of very illogical steps, but somehow you managed to make some sense of it in terms of giving us, you know, the logic that should prevail.
So, I'm not making this stuff up. It's real.
I know. I've been following it. It's unbelievable, but it's going to happen soon at a city near you, right?
I don't think we could publish a novel like this. No one probably would want to publish it because it just doesn't seem real, but it is.
Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
And we'll,
thank
of course, you. You'll keep us posted as it goes. Thank you so much. Well, the president was in New York at the 16th annual convention of the National Action Network and, of course, delivered a speech. And, yes, I know, I'm hearing you. I am hearing you. Are we going to hear a speech by this guy? Yes, the commander-in-chief speaking at the organization headed by the snitch in chief. So we're going to have to hear the speech. Why? It is very important because there is so much that comes through the president, even when he isn't aware of it. He's communicating very interesting things. And here he talks at the National Action Network's convention, and he's talking about, essentially, he says, it is the duty, probably solely and especially the duty of African Americans to basically secure the Democratic Party through the vote. And if they don't do this, don't blame me for the dire consequences that the Republicans will bring to bear on you. So with that, let's listen to the speech. It's a pretty long clip, but if we don't get through it today, definitely we will continue the discussion tomorrow, but I want to share this with you. You listen again, my mother would say, listen with your listening ears for all of these clues that are being given in the speech, because we will analyze it in the way that we customarily do. Here is the President of the United States issuing his dire forecast and warning at the convention of the National Action Network in New York.
My mind this week, some of you may know that yesterday I was down in Austin, Texas at the LBJ Library to speak on the 50th anniversary of the Civil Rights Act and the man who signed it into law. And standing there, I thought of all the Americans, known and unknown, who made it possible for me to stand in that spot, who marched and organized and sat in and stood up for jobs and for justice. And I thought of all who achieved that great victory and others, not just with respect to the Civil Rights Act, but the Voting Rights Act and the Fair Housing Act and immigration reform and Medicare and Medicaid and the first battles of a long war on poverty. And over the past 5 years, in the wake of the worst economic crisis of our lifetimes, we've won some victories too. Nearly 9 million new jobs in America's businesses over the past 4 years. 7.5 million Americans signing up to buy health care coverage under the Affordable Care Act. And millions more who've gained coverage through Medicaid and CHIP, and young people being able to stay on their parents' plans. The rate of uninsured Americans is down. High school dropout rates are down. Our high school graduation rate is the highest on record. More young people are earning college degrees than ever before. We've made progress, and we've taken action. But we also know our work is unfinished. Too many Americans working harder than ever just to get by. Too many Americans who aren't working at all. We know we have to do more to restore America's promise of opportunity for all people, particularly for communities hardest hit by the recession, particularly for those who struggled since long before the recession, not only African Americans and Latinos, but Americans trapped across the country in pockets of poverty, inner city, suburban, rural. And we know what opportunity means. Opportunity means more good jobs that pay good wages. Opportunity means training folks for those jobs. Opportunity means changing the odds for all of our children through pre-K, something Mayor de Blasio's fighting for here in New York City. And opportunity means affordable higher education for all who are willing to work for it. Opportunity means answering the call to be my brother's keeper and helping more boys and young men of color stay on track and reach their full potential. Before I came out, I was in a photo line, saw my good friend Freddie Haynes, a great pastor from the great state of Texas, and he told me this summer they're going to hire 100 young men, pay them $10.10 an hour, maybe $10.50. As a consequence of this call, and the point is that my brother's keeper, that's not just something I do, that's not just something the government does, that's something everybody can participate in. Because we know these young men need support. Opportunity means making the minimum wage a wage you can live on. It means equal pay for equal work. It means overtime pay for workers who've earned it. It means continuing to extend the right of quality, affordable health care for every American in every state, because we've got some states that aren't doing the right thing. We have states who, just out of political spite, are leaving millions of people uninsured that could be getting health insurance right now. No good reason for it. If you ask them what's the explanation, they can't really tell you. And by the way, making sure our citizens have the opportunity to lead healthy lives also means dealing with things like the dangerous carbon pollution that's disproportionately affecting low-income communities. It means making sure that our young people are eating right, so you know, listen to Michelle. I'm just saying. So we know we've got more work to do to bridge the gap between our founding ideals and the realities of our time. And the question then becomes, well, how do we actually make these changes? How does it happen? How do we get a minimum wage bill passed? How do we make sure that those states that aren't yet implementing the Affordable Care Act actually are doing right by their citizens? It means being vigilant. We've got to be vigilant to secure the gains we've made, but also to make more gains in the future. And that's the meaning of these last 50 years since the Civil Rights Act was passed. Because across the country, right now, there are well-organized and well-funded efforts to undo these gains. And one of those gains is under particular assault right now, and that's what I want to spend the rest of my time here talking about. Just as inequality feeds on injustice, opportunity requires justice, and justice requires the right to vote. Johnson, President Johnson, right after he signed the Civil Rights Act into law, told his advisors, some of whom were telling him, well, all right, just wait. You've done a big thing now. Let's let the dust settle. Don't stir folks up. He said, no, I can't wait. We've got to press forward and pass the Voting Rights Act. Johnson said, about this there can be and should be no argument. Every American citizen must have an equal right to vote. Voting is a time when we all have an equal say. Black or white, rich or poor, man or woman. Doesn't matter. In the eyes of the law, and in the eyes of our democracy, we're all supposed to have that equal right to cast our ballot to help determine the direction of our society. The principle of one person, one vote is the single greatest tool we have to redress an unjust status quo. You would think there would not be an argument about this anymore. But the stark, simple truth is this. The right to vote is threatened today in a way that it has not been since the Voting Rights Act became law nearly five decades ago. Across the country, Republicans have led efforts to pass laws making it harder, not easier, for people to vote. In some places, women could be turned away from the polls just because they're registered under their maiden name, but their driver's license has their married name. Senior citizens who've been voting for decades may suddenly be told they can no longer vote until they can come up with the right ID. In other places, folks may learn that without a document like a passport or a birth certificate, they can't register. About 60% of Americans don't have a passport. Just because you don't have the money to travel abroad doesn't mean you shouldn't be able to vote here at home. And just to be clear, I know where my birth certificate is, but a lot of people don't. A lot of people don't. I think it's still up on a website somewhere. You remember that? That was crazy. That was some crazy stuff. I haven't thought about that in a while. Now, I want to be clear. I am not against reasonable attempts to secure the ballot. We understand that there has to be rules in place. But I am against requiring an ID that millions of Americans don't have. That shouldn't suddenly prevent you from exercising your right to vote. The first words put to paper in our American story tell us that all of us are created equal. And we understand that it took a long time to make sure that those words meant something. But 50 years ago, we put laws in place because of enormous struggles to vindicate that idea, to make our democracy truly mean something. And that makes it wrong to pass laws that make it harder for any eligible citizen to vote, especially because every citizen doesn't just have the right to vote, they have a responsibility to vote. So, yes, we're right to be on guard against voter fraud. Voter fraud would impinge on our democracy as well. We don't want folks voting that shouldn't be voting. We all agree on that. Let's stipulate to that, as the lawyers say. But there's a reason why those who argue that harsh restrictions on voting are somehow necessary to fight voter fraud are having such a hard time proving any real widespread voter fraud. So I just want to give you some statistics. One recent study found only 10 cases of alleged in-person voter impersonation in 12 years. 10 cases. Another analysis found that out of 197 million votes cast for federal elections between 2002 and 2005, only 40 voters out of 197 million were indicted for fraud. Now, for those of you who are math majors, as a percentage, that is 0.00002%. That's not a lot. So let's be clear. The real voter fraud is people who try to deny our rights by making bogus arguments about voter fraud. And I have to say, there have been some of these officials who've been passing these laws have been more blunt. They said this is going to be good for the Republican Party. Some of them have not been shy about saying that they're doing this for partisan reasons. Now, it is wrong, President Johnson said, deadly wrong, to deny any of your fellow Americans the right to vote in this country. It is wrong to change our election rules just because of politics. It is wrong to make citizens wait for 5, 6, 7 hours just to vote. It is wrong to make a senior citizen who no longer has a driver's license jump through hoops and have to pay money just to exercise the rights she has cherished for a lifetime. America did not stand up and did not march and did not sacrifice to gain the right to vote for themselves and for others, only to see it denied to their kids and their grandchildren. We've got to pay attention to this. Some of the folks from Chicago know, Crowder knows, one of the first jobs I had out of law school was to lead a voter registration drive in my home state of Illinois. We registered more than 150,000 new voters. And as an organizer, I got to help other citizens exercise their most cherished and fundamental rights. That mattered to me. And as president, I'm not going to let attacks on these rights go unchallenged. We're not going to let voter suppression go unchallenged. So earlier this week, you heard from the Attorney General, and there's a reason the agency he runs is called the Department of Justice. They've taken on more than 100 voting rights cases since 2009. They've defended the rights of everybody from African Americans to Spanish speakers to soldiers serving overseas. Earlier this year, a bipartisan commission I appointed, chaired by my election lawyer and Mitt Romney's election lawyer, came up with a series of modern or common sense reforms to modernize voter registration and to curb the potential for fraud in a smart way and ensure that no one has to wait for more than half an hour to cast a ballot. States and local election boards should take up those recommendations. And with the 50th anniversary of Freedom Summer almost upon us, I urge members of Congress to honor those who gave their lives so that others could exercise their rights and update the Voting Rights Act. Go ahead and get that done. Do it because the right to vote is something cherished by every American. We should not be having an argument about this. There are a lot of things we can argue about. But the right to vote. I mean, what kind of political platform is that? Why would you make that a part of your agenda, preventing people from voting? How can you defend that? There are a whole bunch of folks out there who don't vote for me, didn't vote for me, don't like what I do. The idea that I would prevent them from voting and exercising their franchise makes no sense. Black or white, man or woman, urban, rural, rich, poor, Native American, disabled, gay, straight, Republican or Democrat, voters who want to vote should be able to vote, period, full stop. Voting's not a Democratic issue, it's not a Republican issue, it's an issue of citizenship. It's what makes our democracy strong. But it's a fact. This recent effort to restrict the vote has not been led by both parties. It's been led by the Republican Party. And in fairness, it's not just Democrats who are concerned. You know, you had one Republican state legislator point out, and I'm quoting here, making it more difficult for people to vote is not a good sign for a party that wants to attract more people. That's a good insight. Right? I want a competitive Republican Party, just like a competitive Democratic Party. That's how our democracy is supposed to work, the competition of ideas. But I don't want folks changing the rules to try to restrict people's access to the ballot. And I think responsible people, regardless of your party affiliation, should agree with that. If your strategy depends on having fewer people show up to vote, that's not a sign of strength. That's a sign of weakness. And not only is it ultimately bad politics, I believe ultimately it harms the entire country. If voting is denied to the many, we risk ending up stuck year after year with special interest policies that benefit a fortunate few, and injustice perpetuates inequality. But remember, just as injustice perpetuates inequality, justice opens up opportunity. And as infuriating as efforts to roll back hard-earned rights can be, the trajectory of our history has to give us hope. The story of America is a story of progress. No matter how often or how intensely that progress has been challenged, ultimately this nation has moved forward. As Dr. King said, the arc of the moral universe is long. It bends towards justice. We move forward on civil rights, and we move forward on workers' rights, and we move forward on women's rights and disability rights and gay rights. We showed that when ordinary citizens come together to participate in this democracy we love, justice will not be denied. So the single most important thing we can do to protect our right to vote is to vote. I'm gonna make one last point here. We're gonna have an attorney general that looks at all the laws that are being passed. We're gonna have civic organizations that are making sure that state laws and local laws are doing what they're supposed to do. We will fight back whenever we see unfairly the franchise being challenged. But the truth is that for all these laws that are being put in place, the biggest problem we have is people giving up their own power. voluntarily not participating. The number of people who voluntarily don't vote, who are eligible to vote, dwarfs whatever these laws are put in place might do in terms of diminishing the voting rolls. So we can't treat these new barriers as an excuse not to participate. We can't use cynicism as an excuse not to participate. Sometimes I hear people saying, well, we haven't gotten everything we need. You know, we still have poverty. We still have problems. Of course, these things didn't happen overnight. When I was down in Texas, everybody's celebrating the day that the civil rights law was finally passed. Remember, there were decades in which people sacrificed and worked hard. Change doesn't happen overnight, but it happens as long as we don't purposely give our power away. Every obstacle put in our path should remind us of the power we hold in our hands each time we pull that lever or fill in that oval or touch that screen. We just have to harness that power. We've got to create a national network committed to taking action. We can call it the National Action Network. So I want you to go out there and redouble your efforts. Register more voters. Help more folks to get their rights. Get those souls to the polls. If they don't let you do it on Sunday, then do it on Tuesday instead. I know it's better going to the polls on Sunday because you go to church, you get a little meal. You got the bus waiting for you. I understand, but you can do it without that if we have to. We're at a time when we're marking many anniversaries. And it's interesting for me, yeah, I've been on this earth 52 years, and so to see the progress we've made is to see my own life and the progression that's happened. You think about Brown versus Board of Education and the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act and Freedom Summer. And with those anniversaries, we have new reason to remember those who made it possible for us to be here. Like the three civil rights workers in Mississippi, two white, one black, who were murdered 50 years ago as they tried to help their fellow citizens register to vote. James Cheney and Andrew Goodman and Michael Schwerner believed so strongly that change was possible, they were willing to lay down their lives for it. The least you can do is take them up on the gift that they have given you. Go out there and vote. You can make a change. You do have the power. I've run my last election, but I need you to make sure that the changes that we started continue for decades to come. Thank you. God bless you. God bless America.
Okay. All right. So we got the point of that speech. Get those souls to the polls, he says. And this, to me, is a very offensive speech. And it offends on a number of levels. The president, of course, expects a very friendly environment, people who love him and will show him great warmth. And so he's kind of loose with the facts. For example, he says that more people are graduating from college than ever before. That is not true. He talks about the wonderful opportunity that would be provided 100 young black men this summer through his Brother's Keeper initiative. Well, that's good. But if we were to work the percentage, we'll know that those 100, I don't even know how many digits after zero one can go to find out what percentage of eligible people who should be working, not as part of a philanthropic effort, but as part of the government's response to a crisis in unemployment. And he dodges all kinds of bullets here. It talks about the young people because he has nothing to say about their parents. He can't discuss employment opportunities for their parents. He talks about the 9 million new jobs. Well, he ought to talk to an economist or two to find out what percentage, number one, across the board for every job that is gotten across the board, almost four people were in line for the same job. Four more people. And when you look at the African-American, Latino, First Nations people, you find that the statistic is beyond overwhelming. It is almost impossible to believe. But African-Americans, the group that he's addressing here, in terms of employment, are seeing the worst kind of employment since the Depression. And it is now permanent. In other words, we've had a new group of people added, and that is people who have been unemployed for so long, years now, that they cannot get a job. He talks about all the wonderful things that have been done by his administration, but carefully avoiding the critical questions that we all know. He talks about schools and how more people are graduating from high schools, and we know here you can't pull that fast one, not here, because his administration has closed down more schools than any other in the history of the United States. And in fact, he is overseeing, the Education Department is overseeing a re-entrenchment of segregation in schools, and segregation at housing, and segregation in everything else. Barack Obama, in fact, is the president of an apartheid United States of America. That's the effect, the net effect of his administration's policies, creating two Americas once again. It is significant that he mentions that he was in Texas observing the 50th anniversary of President Lyndon Johnson's signing into law the Civil Rights Act. And again, just to be clear, let's get the record straight. Yes, he signed it into law because he was facing incredible pressure from organized opposition, principally among African American groups. Adam Clayton Powell, Martin Luther King, people who bore down on this question. We had James Farmer, we had Bayard Rustin, in fact, who was very much a leader in this effort, organizing more than 500,000 people and embarrassing the administration into doing the right thing. The Civil Rights Act that people are trumping about and the president is talking about being signed in 1964. He wouldn't tell you that the first Civil Rights Act was actually passed in 1866, and nothing happened after 1866 until 1964. How many futures were squandered? How many bright young minds destroyed? How many people did not participate in the so-called American dream from 1866? And that is just around the Civil Rights Act. That does not discuss the preceding 100 years of activity leading up to 1866, when they kind of sort of relented and came up with something they call the Civil Rights Act. This president has decided that he doesn't have to really account to anybody. He came into friendly territory. Yeah, we all right. You know, we got you back. Yo, bro, Everything is aight. Yeah, aight. People are suffering like they've never suffered before. And still this president has the temerity to say that, you know, you have to go out again. I'm coming to you again. It's not enough that blacks put him in office, not once, but twice, and continue to be ignored by his administration. And that, ignored is a nice word. Abused is more likely the more accurate word. But now they must tote that barge and lift that bale one more time without having any evidence of what it is he has delivered specifically to this constituency, him and his party, the same Democratic Party that has abused the heck out of the black community, ignoring its needs, ignoring its wants, especially ignoring its contributions. This party has benefited enormously from the votes of African Americans and, in fact, has dishonored those votes. You have rampant poverty and inequality in America today. You have people who can't get to feed their families today. And they voted. And still, folks open their arms and say, sure, we will help you once again. And what is his message? His message is, gimme. That's his message. Not only just gimme, I'm entitled to ask you. And I ask you fully expecting that you will undertake this enterprise. So anytime soon, you will now hear the National Action Network announcing yet another national drive, which will be subsidized by organizations and parties unknown, to undertake to have their folks go out of the street again and go door to door, street to street, house to house, to come up with all kinds of information like they did. They built a multi-million dollar information empire, which is now churning out millions of dollars for people who didn't even raise a finger to gather the data. They brought the data, they didn't get paid, they brought the data back to headquarters, and guess what? The folks who now have that data are advising political candidates, even in Britain, on how to win. Having perfected the science with the unwitting and unknowing help of willing black folks toting that barge and lifting that bale. This president is a disgrace. And somebody needs to stand up and say, why should we care? Why should we care about you and your Democratic Party? What objective reason is there to put our energy into a lost cause? But, you know, being in politics means you're brazen. You have a strength that few people have when you're in politics at this level. Because the confidence is, hey, I'm smart. I know what I'm doing. And I could get you to do what I want you to do. So you go out there and tote that barge and lift that bale. See you tomorrow. Thanks.